honored with a retirement ceremony in Belmont's Winner's Circle. Girl Scouts, from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial. About 200,000 Girl Scouts gathered on the National Mall in Washington today, marking the Girl Scouts' 100th anniversary. I'm Dick Iuliano, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, developing solutions to support strong families and communities for America's children at aecf.org.
Join KRVS for 2 hours of hardcore multi-generational roots rock reggae here on Jamon. Cecil here, booming the Ariites every Sunday night, live in studio from 9 to 11 p.m. The rebroadcast Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m. Rasta Reggae Radio, doing it King David style. That's Jamon, here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Public radio for Acadiana.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the big show today. It's so nice to have all of you with us on this glorious day of great weather. We're in the month of May, and all is right in the world today.
Mm-hmm. All is right in the world?
Mm-hmm. In my mind, that is.
That is a big statement.
Well, in my mind, all is right in the world today.
Good.
In my world, I'm talking about. Anyway, y'all, we're so happy to have you joining us today at the kitchen table as our executive producer, Michelle Yark. How are you doing?
Howdy. Mm-hmm. I'm great. Thank you so much.
And our historian and archivist, Shirley Sands. Shirley, what you been up to?
Oh, just trying to enjoy every minute of these days.
Across the glass wall, of course, our engineering team is back up and running. They've been out on vacation here for about 2-3 months, huh?
Well, you know.
But not quite that long. It just seems, you see, we miss you when you're gone. That's why I think it was 2 or 3 months. It was only a week or two, but. I was in a store the other day, as I am constantly since it's a part of my research. There was a demonstration going on, and it was the cooking and preparing of all kind of different pastas, different colors, different shapes, different sizes. One thing I love about pasta is just that. I'm sure it wasn't going to be as easy as, well, you know, there's spaghetti and there's a little linguine and, you know, there's a little spaghettini and, you know, I knew it wasn't going to be that easy. Because when you get into the world of pasta, well, I tell you.
The whole new world opens up, huh?
But anyway, I thought it would be a great topic for the big show today because, I mean, everybody loves pasta. Pasta continues to be one of the top food ingredients sought after by the dining public and certainly one of the number one or two restaurant types in the country that people seek out other than Asian is going to be Italian because of the pasta. After all, you know, pasta, noodles, dumplings, and so many other great foods have been around for a long, long time. They're what we call comfort foods, the things that people recognize because even if you think about it, probably a young child eating their first pasta is going to, if they're unlucky, is going to have mom pop the top off of a little can of
Chef Boyardee noodles.
Chef Boyardee noodles. But it's recognized. It's like baby food to them, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and of course, baby food does contain the pasta as well.
That's right.
So they've been around for a long time. Of course, you can get into a lot of debates, like what's the difference between a pasta and a noodle? Is there a difference? Who created pasta to begin with? What kind of flour do you use? And can you use other things other than flour, which of course we know you can't? Over the years, many of school children in their history classes or in their folklore classes were taught that it was the Venetian merchant Marco Polo who brought pasta back from one of his journeys to China. Another version also says that Polo's discovery was actually a rediscovery of the foodstuff that was once popular in Italy in Etruscan and Roman times. Marco Polo may have done amazing things on that journey, but bringing pasta back to Italy wasn't one of them. It was already in Italy by Marco Polo's time. There's some evidence that the Etrusco-Roman noodle made from the same durum wheat as modern pasta. In fact, they call it lagani, which we think is the origin of the word lasagna, was already popular there. This food first mentioned in the first century A.D. was not what we think of today as kind of like noodles going into boiling water with a little salt, you know. In fact, it was cooked by the Romans in ovens. This type of pasta that they were doing. So while there might have been some slight similarities, ancient lagani cannot be actually considered a pasta. The next culinary leap in the history of pasta is when the Arabs, invading everybody in the world, including Western Mediterranean in the 8th century, they began to influence, obviously, the regional cuisine. The dried noodle-like product they introduced to Sicily is most likely the origin of the dried pasta that we know today, and it was produced in great quantities in Palermo at this time. How it was served is not really known, but many Sicilian pasta recipes still include Arab culinary gifts, such as raisins and spices like cinnamon and nutmeg and all of these wonderful things. In fact, most Sicilian food historians will be more than happy to debate that the original pasta came from the shores south of Palermo and was made with sardines and raisins and capers by the Romans or the Etruscans.
Which sounds really delicious, actually.
Well, it is. I've eaten it there. Well, you know, we know that the early pasta was an ideal staple for Sicily, and it easily spread to the mainland since durum wheat thrives in this Italian climate. Italy is still a major producer of this hard wheat, and it's used to make that all-important semolina flour that most people consider the best to make pasta with. Mm-hmm. By the 1300s, dried pasta was very popular for its nutrition and, of course, more importantly, its shelf life. You know, by drying it, you could it would hold up ideally on those long ship voyages and all of that as people travel around the world. Yeah.
Is there a shelf life on pasta?
Yeah, forever.
I guess that works.
Well,
huh?
I have wondered that because sometimes, you know, you buy different kinds and you store them. And
well, as long as it's properly packaged and wrapped nice and put in a way it doesn't get wet or damp or whatever. But, I mean, it's a dried product that is reconstituted in water. So it's a dehydrated product, so to speak, you know. So unless bugs get into it, you'll be all right. When he comes around and spray the bugs on every month. Mm-hmm. You got a bug man?
I don't have a bug man.
Okay. Well, I'd throw the pasta away if I were you. By the time pasta started to travel around the world, people started to discover it. They started to discover, of course, the different shapes of the pasta that started to appear, the new technology that made pasta a little easier to make with some machinery that was being done. As far as this country is concerned, it seems that the first pasta known in America was macaroni. Macaroni came with the English, who served it baked with what else? Cream and cheese. Baked macaroni. Of course, here's our buddy Thomas Jefferson again, and legends are by the thousands about Thomas Jefferson when it comes to food, and most people think that he introduced dried pasta without eggs to America, and while that's a legend, of course, we know that he did take notes on the manufacturing process during one of his trips to Naples, because he was such an aficionado of all new and exciting and interesting things European in food and wine. He wanted to know all about it. He was quite experimental in his love of good food.
He loved to eat it, and as you said, he had to know a little bit more about it, and then he went on to try to make it. Didn't he buy a pasta machine?
Well, he had a friend of his in Italy buy a macaroni machine, and in 1789, we actually have the shipping document over at Monticello that shows that he shipped himself 2 cases of pasta with the macaroni machine. So we know it came in. It was in 1798 that a Frenchman opened what may have been the first American pasta factory in Philadelphia, and by all accounts, it was immediately successful. How could it not be? Spaghetti and meatballs. My God, who wouldn't like that? By the Civil War, macaroni was available available to all the working classes. Cookbooks of the period indicate that the common way to serve it was to cook it until soft, bake it with cream and cheese, and eat. Simple as that. And today it's still the number one way to eat pasta out of a blue box.
Macaroni and cheese. Talk about comfort food. Everybody loves macaroni and cheese.
And by the mid-1880s, macaroni recipes could be found in cookbooks everywhere, including the plains of Kansas. It was a huge wave of Italian immigrants that began at the end of the 19th century that was ultimately responsible for pasta becoming a staple in the American middle class. Isn't that interesting?
Even in Louisiana, when the Italian immigrants came in, they established macaroni factories around Amy.
That's exactly right. In fact, it's one of those early machines are still operating in Baton Rouge today over at Fresina's Pasta Company. If you ever want to see one of these old machines working and you're in the Baton Rouge area there, it's like a little mini museum almost.
It is.
They'd love for you to watch. And it is. And they've had to recreate the parts and pieces. But anyway, it's really good. With over 5 million Italian immigrants coming to America between 1880 and 1921 after that reunification movement failed in Italy and Sicily, pasta with vegetables and fruit and cheese became a staple here in this country. The rest is pretty much, as we say, history, because I cannot think of any other raw ingredient or main dish that is probably more acceptable from children to the elderly than pasta. I guess it's what goes into the pasta. If you're going to do a sardine pasta, you might have a little kickback. But if you're going to have bolognese, pasta bolognese, a little ground meat or just a... And you know one of the interesting things about pasta, I've taken a couple of trips to Italy, and I was very fortunate to tour a couple of the pasta factories of Italy, but also I was very excited to eat at the home of a wonderful, absolutely wonderful Italian lady who was making her pasta from scratch and making her sauce, her tomato sauce. And she said something that was translated to us that really was spectacular. She says, "In Italy, there's nothing better than a tomato off the vine eaten with just a little piece of salt." So, a little sprig of salt. So she says, "In America, we learn that people think to cook the tomato a long time in their sauce is the right thing to do." She says, "If you go back to America to tell them about the pasta, you tell them that's a mistake. The best a tomato can be is just to be warmed by the sun. So always start to make your tomato sauce when you drop your pasta in the water to boil."
Oh, my gosh.
12 minutes. It's done because, and think how right she was. The best a tomato will ever be is off of the vine, warmed by the sun, with a little sprinkle of salt. You can't get a better tomato than that.
No.
So she's saying, why are you cooking this thing? Cut it up, dice it, put it in the pan with a little olive oil and onion and garlic. Slice your garlic very thin, a little basilico, a little basil. Toss the pan two or three times for 12 minutes while the pasta's cooking. Then you have a magnificent pasta. Think about that for a minute.
That really does sound pretty delicious.
But just think how reasonable that conversation is. Rather than cook your tomato 8 hours. She said, why? She said, is this real that they do this in America? I said, well, a lot of the people in America think the longer you make a roux, the better it is, too. I said, it doesn't have to be that way. Anyway, y'all, today we're talking about one of our favorite subjects. Obviously, we're talking food. And not only are we talking food, we're talking about one of our favorite foods. We're talking about pasta and pasta with vegetables and fruit and cheese and all other kinds of great stuff that goes in it. And we have a great guest. We have a cookbook author who wrote Making Artisanal or Artisan Pasta. She's from Philadelphia. She's going to be here. Michelle is going to introduce her in a minute. And I'm going to cook a recipe, too. So you don't want to go anywhere. Today is going to be a great pasta show.
Well, I love my macaroni, and I really love my cheese. Put them both together, and it brings me to my knees. I love my macaroni, macaroni and cheese. Macaroni, macaroni and cheese. Well, I see those yummy noodles, and I see the cheese on top. And when I eat my mac and cheese, it's just so hard to stop. I love my macaroni, macaroni and cheese. Macaroni, macaroni and cheese. Oh, I'll have a bowl for breakfast, I'll have a plate for lunch. And when it comes to supper, oh, I don't want a little, I want a whole bunch of macaroni, macaroni and cheese.
macaroni and cheese.
This is Diego Martin Perez. Join me on Sundays at 6 p.m. and late night Wednesdays at 1 a.m. for La Bellonera, an exploration of Latin American music of today and yesteryear. La Bellonera, Sundays at 6 p.m., Wednesday nights at 1 a.m. here on KRBS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I love pasta, it's my favorite thing to eat. Any way you serve it to me, I will think that it's a treat. Boil the water, cook it in a pot, and sauce it in a pan. Then dump it out onto my plate, and I'll eat all I can. Fettuccine, spaghetti, mantecotti, ravioli, tortellini, cannelloni, rigatoni, bucatini, baked lasagna, and baked ziti, pasta penne, and linguine, farfalle, fusilli, macaroni and cheese. Farfalle, fusilli, macaroni and cheese.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Starting It Up, the best tasting show on radio. That's my favorite pasta song right there.
Is it? It is a great song.
Oh, that's a great, great, great song. Absolutely. I love it. Anyway, y'all, it's so great to have all of you back with us at the kitchen table today as we talk about one of our favorite subjects, pasta. Not just Italian, but all kinds of noodles and dumplings. And how can you not love pasta? Introduce our guest today and let's chat a little bit about it.
Absolutely. Our guest is Aliza Green. She is a Philadelphia-based chef and consultant, and she is a James Beard Award-winning author. Now, she's written more than a dozen books, including the Field Guide series, and within that series are volumes on produce, meats, herbs and spices, and seafood. As you mentioned, Making Artisan Pasta, one of Aliza's books. Fabulous. She's had a very successful career in writing. She's written for the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Daily News, and she writes for some of our favorite magazines, such as Cooking Light. We're so pleased to have Aliza in the studio with us today. Welcome to Stirring It Up, Aliza.
Well, thank you. I love to stir it up, and it sounds like you just love everything food, no matter what it is. And I agree with that, as long as it's good food. You know, there's too much bad food out there, so we eliminate a lot when we say that, just good food.
Aliza, you're so right, and welcome to Stirring It Up. We happen to have you in the bayous of Louisiana, and all of our listeners today are hearing your voice. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
Aliza, I read that you are a pasta fanatic, and that you have been since you were 6 years old when you traveled for the first time to Italy.
Well, I think that is... I don't have a family background, you know, the Italian family or any of that kind of thing. So either I was there in a past life or it's just because I have done so much travel there and I've had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in Italy and, of course, some of the other places where the, you know, other dishes, other kinds of noodle dishes come from, but particularly in Italy. Yes, and I did. I spent the summer there when I was 6. I was back again when I was 12. I was back again when I was 17. And then between the ages of basically 17 and 25 or 24 when I really got into professional cooking, I was in school, but I would work until I had enough money to travel, and then come back, and then work again. And eventually I decided, you know, I really need to do something that is going to have a focus, you know, that's going to take advantage of this. And I started to cook. I had a catering company, and eventually I started cooking in restaurants, and really that was what allowed me to follow that passion that I've had my entire life. And as far as pasta is just fun. It's fun in the mouth. It's fun to make. It's fun for all ages. And I think that pasta is having another moment. In the 70s, it was big. And then I think what happened is that I started getting a lot of the processed stuff. You know, you can buy the modified atmosphere packaging, the fettuccine and the ravioli and that kind of stuff. And the stuff is decent, but it's just not the same as making it yourself. And right now, lots of people are into, DIY, do it yourself. In fact, several people, more than one person, has written to me to say that they're using this book to help them prepare pastas they're selling in local farmers markets. So it's a small business. So I think that's pretty fabulous.
You know, when I think of your career, reading a little bit about your history and you having an opportunity to study as you did, well, first of all, travel as you did, which is really great. I always admire people. You know, being born in the swamp lands of Louisiana, our opportunity to travel was from the bayous to the river. We had about 8 to 10 feet of travel on high land. And when I look at the opportunity that people have had to travel and where you have studied with Marcella Hayes working as an executive chef, I just admire the work that y'all do. Tell us a little bit about some of your early studying in cooking as a chef. Kind of bring us up to date on that background a little bit.
I am one of those self-taught chefs, much more common in the people in the more mature generation, because we didn't really have the cooking schools at the time. It was very limited. I know when I was really the age of thinking about going to culinary school, the Culinary Institute of America, which was basically the only school at the time, didn't even have an Italian program.
Right.
And that was always what I loved. I was always into, you know, making things from scratch, making things, you know, the right way. No shortcuts. I mean, I never used a bottled or boxed or canned soup base in my life. I'm certainly not going to start now. I started because I wanted to serve authentic Italian food. After a number of years, I had several different jobs at some really top restaurants in the city, but eventually I got a break where I started as sous chef, but then fairly quickly was promoted to executive chef of a wonderful northern Italian restaurant. That was in 1979, and that's where I got to work with Marcella Hazan. At that point, I started looking for farmers to grow some of the kinds of produce that I couldn't get here. You know, things that seem so common now, like a yellow pepper, or some of the greens that we have, or zucchini blossom. You still have to have somebody bring you that because they have to be picked that morning so they're nice and open so you can stuff them. And, oh, my God, is that a delicious thing. So I would actually, I think the statute of limitations has run out because that's 30 years ago, but I would bring seeds back from Europe, which you were not allowed to do at the time. Now you can. And I found farmers, and that was really one of the best things that I did, was being able to do, you know, work with the farmers, get the stuff locally grown, and then making everything from scratch. I mean, working with Marcella was fabulous for me because I got to actually go to her course in Bologna and then work, not for a long time, but in some restaurants there, and really learn from the best. But I always had that home cook viewpoint, which is we don't take shortcuts. We do things the right way. And that's really what gives the satisfaction. And from there, I was at that restaurant for 6 years. Then I went to another restaurant, which was called Apropos. It was a Mediterranean bistro. It was kind of at the time when California Mediterranean was really big. We had the wood oven, which I still love. I mean, I've had that in two restaurants. Best kind of flavored cooking you could do, if it's real wood. It's not one of those fake ones where they have a little wood, but it's really gas. And even there, we made all of our own pasta, but maybe it was a little bit more, wasn't as classical as what I made in the Italian restaurant, which was Ristorante di Lulo. This Apropos was, you know, a little bit more breaking open, maybe using some of the herbs and spices that I had, you know, that weren't strictly part of the Italian repertoire. And went on from there. I was a partner at a pretty well-known restaurant in Philly called the White Dog Cafe that became was prominent for using all locally grown. And then, in the meantime, I got pregnant. I had two children. Drove from work to the hospital to have my son. I was working on the line, expediting at 9 p.m. And I said, I'm feeling a little weird. Maybe I better go home. My son was born at 2 a.m. 5 hours later.
Oh my gosh, that's dedication.
I mean, this is the kind of stuff that, you know, that I would do. But I had a brand new menu, and I wanted to see every dish come out at least one time. So that was it.
You and I obviously had we're the same age, so we came. I also, dying to learn to cook, had no opportunity to go to culinary school, so I also had to do the same thing, go through apprenticeship. I was lucky to spend many, many years in a row in Philadelphia with the Book and the Cook when it was and I was at the White Dog on one of our cooking weekends, at Der Chimney and a couple of other places. There was a Louisiana restaurant. What was the name of that restaurant? Nola or something like that?
Nola, yeah.
Was it Nola? Yeah, and I cooked there once. So I used to come for the Book and the Cook, which I absolutely loved. And, of course, the Reading Market and all that over there was just so, so spectacular. It really, it was in Philadelphia that I think with the Book and the Cook, meeting chefs that I had never seen. Chefs, as you well know, didn't travel and communicate and share ideas so much back then. You only met on occasion. And that's when it was at the Book and the Cook that you started to rub, that I first started to rub shoulders with other cooks and other chefs and going to the market and looking at ingredients and looking at pastas and seeing the meats and the cheeses at the back counter and thinking to myself, my God, what is this stuff? So Philadelphia was actually a really mind-opening experience for a young cook coming from the swamplands of Louisiana. So I love your city, you know.
Well, I'm really glad. I'm glad to hear that our city had a positive effect on your illustrious career.
A big effect, believe me.
Well, it sounds like you just had a crazy, crazy schedule. So how in creation did you manage to write 12 cookbooks?
Well,
what got you into the idea of writing?
The two things that have been the most important in my life, as far as things that I love to do, is travel and reading. Mm-hmm. I was, a huge, voracious reader, and I'm still a voracious reader. So, and many of the things that I learned were from reading these, so many wonderful cookbooks. And so I think that was bringing those two together that really I had that dream of being able to write. And language. I mean, even like when I worked in the Italian restaurant, I worked there my 6 days a week. On the seventh day, I took a private Italian lesson. I did that for 5 years because I felt like I wanted to learn the language in order to be able to read cookbooks in the original, be able to go over there because I would travel there every year and, talk with the people in the market, talk with the food, the person making the pasta in the little shop, ask them questions. And so I think that those two strands really come together with the books. And you asked me about how I was able to get so much done. I'd say that my training as a chef, I can think on my feet. I'm fast. I can make a decision. And I think that is really, really important. I'm very productive. You had to be in order to be able to survive as a chef. So, and I must have, at least a certain affinity and a certain ability to be able to do that. And I love it. I love being able to communicate people. I love being able to share the information about food, the wonderful stories, the stories about the people, the history, all of the culture part that comes into it. That's really much more my interest. And in fact, I would love to come down to your neck of the woods and learn a little bit more about that with somebody who really knows their way around, because unfortunately I haven't had that much opportunity to spend in Louisiana.
Oh my God.
So,
you
consider it done.
Oh, you must come, and especially with the huge Italian community we have here. I mean, we have one of the largest, obviously, coming after after that reunification failure in Italy, and coming here in the 1800s. Oh my God, you would absolutely love it. We have to do that, okay?
I would love that. Well, I'll tell you one story about New Orleans. I did go was a conference, and of course, I couldn't stand sitting. I mean, I said, I'm not going all the way to New Orleans and sitting inside of some stupid hotel for the entire time. I played hooky, and I went out, and oh my God, I had the best time talking to people and, searching all the used bookstores and the old, antique-y places, because that's the kind of stuff that I love. So on the way home, we're driving to the airport. I said, I have to go to Central Grocery. I can't leave without a muffaletta.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought it, had them wrap it up in that white paper, put it in the bag, and I put it in the overhead compartment in the airplane. By the end of the trip, you have no idea. The garlic and the oregano and the hot pepper, the entire plane had this aroma. And my husband came to pick me up from the airport. airport, and I said, here, I brought you takeout dinner from New Orleans. That's the best. But a cook can understand that, right?
Oh, right. Oh, my God, absolutely. We do it in every city, every town, every plane trip.
I'll never.
Well, that's it. And I have to say, with making artisan pasta, that kind of brought me back to those early roots in cooking that... It was such a pleasure for me, and it came so easily. And I hope that I've been able to make it easy for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, judging by the kind of reader response I've been getting, I think that I really helped to make them understand all the steps. And, you know, with a non-intimidating thing, I want people to have success. I want them to have that pleasure of making your own pasta. I mean, because there's something that's so rewarding about making something from scratch. And what for the pasta? You start with a couple of eggs and a little bit of flour and maybe some, you know, vegetable puree or some saffron or something like that. And you come out with something that you could make into practically any shape or form, stuff it with anything you please, and it's a lot of fun, as I said. So I think that it's been terrific, and the book has been selling extremely well, which I'm very happy about. And also, to go along with that, I am doing a culinary tour in Italy in October, which is a tour in the Maremma, which is the part of Tuscany. It's kind of it's like the Wild West of Tuscany. I call it even the Argentina of Tuscany. That's not very well settled. You have little medieval towns with a lot of wild, hillsides. There's quite a bit of hunting that goes on there, so you'd probably be very familiar with that. The boar, there's signs, you know, watch wild boar crossing and things like that. So we stay in a place we take over in Agriturismo, which is the name for kind of an inn that's on a farm, like a B&B that's on a farm. And so these are friends of mine that own this place, and we take the place over for the whole week, and then we make these trips out every day, come back, all kinds. Some of the meals we have there, some of the meals we have in different places. We visit cheesemaker, top wineries, a chocolatier that does a whole, he makes all of his chocolates with the wine. He comes from Sicily. We were talking Sicily earlier. And then we go on to Orvieto, which is a town about an hour north of Rome, where my several chef friends, they're the people that I actually trained with when I was working on the pasta book, because I wanted to learn to make hand stretch pasta, because that is like to me the ultimate in goodness in pasta. So they each have restaurants, so we do programs, they do demos, we have classes, and we go visit all different kinds of people in
the
area.
Wow.
So it's pretty great, and anybody that wants to know more about it can just visit my website, which is just my name, alizagreen.com, Aliza Green, like the color, Green. And then there's a notice posted, and then there's also an Ask Aliza tab where they can write to me. So I'm happy to, you know, answer any questions. Mm-hmm. And it's we did it last year. I had 14 people last year. It was a wonderful trip, and I hope that some of the listeners out there are interested. But also, anybody that's listening to this show and has a pasta question, I would love to be able to answer. I always answer questions, answer messages from people. It's that connection. I want to share. I want people to have the same success that I've had.
Well, that's really fantastic, and we're definitely going to have you all hooked up to our website, jfalls.com. All of our listeners know Stirring It Up, the radio show, and we have all of our facts and figures and everything for each show on there. We have about 2 minutes left, and Michelle, I know you have a question that you need to ask. And plus, we need to know more about that trip.
Well, was that the first one that you did, Aliza, last year?
That was the first one that I did on my own. I've had several others where I assisted, but this time I moved up to organize it, and I really set it up myself with the help. I work with a company called Epicopia, which specializes in culinary tourism, so they were able to help me handle the financials, you know, making the payouts and finding the bus and the bus driver, things like that I was not that familiar with. But the program itself, I worked out with my friends in Italy. So everybody that we visit are people, you know, I have a personal relationship with, and I think that makes a big difference.
Well, we can tell that you're a kindred spirit, and we have lots of things that we want to continue to talk with you about, so we're just going to have to do another show.
Well, sounds great to me, because I love radio. I think it's the most fun. I've gotten to meet so many wonderful people through the world of radio, so thank you so much for having me on.
And at the same time, we're about to do our new restaurant opening in New Orleans, Restaurant Revolution, myself and Rick Tramato from Chicago. And you may want to take a look at that, because a big part of that restaurant is the Seven Nations that founded Creole cuisine, and of course one of the main ones, Italian. So we'll be doing a lot with Italian, and we would love to have you in one of our seats for that, for when we're doing the Italian week in the restaurant. It would be absolutely wonderful. We will stay in touch. Thank you so much for being with us today. We really enjoyed your conversation.
Oh, thank you.
Okay,
you
y'all
have a wonderful weekend.
Good, thank you. Don't you go anywhere. We're going to be back, and we're going to give you all of her information in just a minute as well.
I think it's nearly supper time. I'm going to pour myself some wine and sit down to a big plate of pasta tonight. It doesn't matter what it costs. I gotta get some pesto sauce to put on my big plate of pasta tonight. Oh, it can be macaroni, rigatoni, man, I don't really care. It can be ravioli, most truly, just give me some angel hair. Don't ask me to get up and dance. Instead, I'm gonna loosen my pants and sit down to a big plate of pasta tonight.
Oh, oh, come. Oh, oh, quelle sensation bizarre.
Franco Mix avec Val. Tous les jeudis soirs à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie. Et c'est formidable.
Quelle sensation bizarre.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
T'as des misères à réveiller les dimanches matins? Mais allume la radio avec moi, Louis Michaud, tous les dimanches matins, 7h jusqu'à 9h. On va charrer en français, écouter la musique en français, et boire une petite tasse de café. Join me, Louis Michaud, if you have trouble waking up in the Sunday mornings. Just turn your radio to KRVS from 7 to 9 and hear me with Le Réveil, The Awakening en Français.
Pasta, pasta, time to eat your pasta. If you eat it every day, it makes your hair grow faster. Pasta, pasta, time to eat your pasta. Mamma mia, meatball, please pass the pasta. On Monday I eat manicotti, Tuesday tortellini, Wednesday ravioli, Thursday fettuccine, Friday cappelletti, Saturday lasagna, Sunday I forgetti, oh yes, of course, spaghetti. Pasta, pasta, time to eat your pasta. If you eat it every day, it makes your hair grow faster.
All right, I never ate it on a bicycle or in a tub, but I bet you can. Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back, y'all. This is Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. And my God, what a great guest Aliza is. What a fact. We need to have her at the culinary school at Nichols State.
Yes,
and
I
we
agree.
Definitely need to have her. Anyway, it would be very interesting traveling Italy with her as a
imagine?
Guide. Well, y'all, we're going to talk a little bit more about pasta. And remember her book, Shirley's going to talk about that. Michelle, we should probably mention our Facebook page, right?
Yeah, oh yes, absolutely. Facebook.com/stirringitupradio.
And I also want to remind everybody, if you go to @ChefJohnFalls on my Twitter page, you're going to see all kind of wonderful tweets that I'm putting up on all kind of different things, all kind of places we go on and all of this. But you should go to @ChefJohnFalls and click onto that. So Shirley, you chose a good topic today.
Well, thank you. And the book was just so fabulous. I want to mention our guest's book, Making Artisan Pasta. I've used it to make some fresh pasta. My first foray into such worlds. I have no Italian background, so it was a scary little move. The photographs that come with it are simple and clear. The writing directions are just amazing. It makes it easy to use. And I also want to mention, her book's the only one I'm mentioning, but don't forget the Savour, Food and Wine, and Cooking Light websites. All three of them have dozens and dozens fabulous recipes to choose from. They're rated by the people who have tried them. And right now, it's kind of springtime. Pasta dishes is the main line front page of all the magazines. And so if you like asparagus, if you like artichokes, if you like anything in the whole wide world, they can come up with fabulous pasta dishes to go with them. So Aliza's book is fabulous, and so are those three websites.
That sounds
awesome. You can find
anything
you want.
I have to admit that when I decide to cook pasta, you know, and I venture down that aisle in the grocery store because, I don't make my own pasta, it's really overwhelming because I think, now, which one of these do I need to get? Because there are so many varieties. But, you know, that's not even a drop in the bucket of the variety of pastas that are out there. Roughly 350 different shapes, different varieties of dried pasta in Italy, and even more when you start looking at the regional differences. And, you know, shapes are, you know, they have the tube pasta, they have bow tie, tennis rackets. Many, but not all of these types are usually available wherever pasta is made. Mm-hmm. By Italian law, dried pasta must be made with 100% durum semolina flour and water. I thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. A practice that all but the worst quality pasta makers worldwide have since adhered to.
So at least I guess we can feel safe that when you buy it in the store, it's going to at least meet that criteria.
Absolutely. There are two factors in dried pasta from Italy that make it typically better than most other products, extrusion and drying methods.
Okay.
No, that's exactly right. And even your local pasta shops, if you have a local pasta shop, whether you're in what city you're in, you're going to find that the best ones have the dried pasta technique where they're actually making it, and then they're drying it in either rooms that have fans and a little heat in it, taking all of that moisture out, and that drying technique is really important for the pasta once it's cooked to be able to gain the texture that holds and grabs the sauces that go onto it. And a lot of your dried pasta, like the tube pasta, that has ridges in it or abrasions, again, that are designed specifically to hold the cream sauces or the red sauces. These little bumps and extrusions in the process are forcing it through these copper molds that you can buy. And you see a lot of these shapes, even some of the schools have their mascots made out of pasta. I know the LSU Tigers, you can get tiger pasta, purple and gold.
That's
coming through these extrusion processes that you just make a mold and run the semolina flour through it, and it makes a little tiger head or something like that. So, and those are very popular, and you find today a lot of clubs and all are doing these dried pastas. Another thing that the mass-produced pasta falls short of really good Italian pasta made the right way. The mass-produced pastas are dried at very high temperatures for shorter times. Traditional pasta is allowed to dry up to 50 hours. If you think about that, two and a half days almost, and the result is a much better mouthfeel, quicker cooking time, 8 to 10 minutes on these kind of pastas. And while dried pasta is what most of us will have access to, there are some places where you can get fresh pasta as well, or soft pasta as it's called. But let me tell you something, in an Italian home in the small regions of Italy, you will never find fresh pasta. It'll always be dried pasta. They love their dried pasta, and they're quick to tell you it's the best because flavor develops through drying. And if they have to make it fast because family's coming and they don't have any and they make it, well, they'll go ahead and make it fresh and cook it. But it's not the best way to eat that pasta, according to them. A couple good quick tips about buying pasta. As Shirley mentioned, a couple of websites a minute ago, very, very important. Y'all ready to cook a little something, man? Want to cook a little pasta dish? How much time I have to cook today, huh? Got a couple of minutes over there? Oh, my God. I can make my pasta fresh and dry it. You know what I feel like doing today? I think I'm going to do crawfish seasons in here Louisiana, right?
Right.
And I thought I would do the crawfish stuff, pasta shells. You know, you have the little bitty pasta shells, and you have the big pasta shells. You know the big ones you get in the boxes? I'm going to use that fresh swamp crawfish, the red swamp crawfish, if I'm lucky enough to have some white river crawfish for that bright orange fat. I have a little bit of that in there, but the red swamp is what I'm looking for. The Atchafalaya Basin is wonderful. The Acadians certainly learned how to put crawfish into their friend's pasta from the neighborhood when the Italians showed up. So here we have this great little dish. Now remember to get a box of those jumbo pasta shells. Cook them in lightly salted water and cook them to al dente. dente because you're going to bake them again. So if it says to cook them for 12 minutes, cook them for 10 minutes, cool them, and then they're going to bake in the sauce anyway, so they're going to continue to cook. That's what I always do. If you overcook them, they kind of lay wide open, and it's difficult to... Michelle, did that happen to you?
Yes, it did.
It did? Yeah. Well, you have to be careful.
I have some experience in this recipe.
Well, people do...
I've never made it again, but it sure was delicious.
Well, you should make it again.
I know.
Recipes, people make mistakes, and they learn from those mistakes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to begin with a quarter pound of butter. That's one block. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to melt it over medium-high heat. And I'm going to add that cup of minced onions, that half a cup of minced green and red bell pepper in there. Little Italian flag going on here. You know what I mean? And make it mince, you know, half a cup each added to those onions. And y'all, I'm just, for some reason, I've changed my habit of mincing garlic. I used to mince my garlic all the time. I do not mince garlic anymore.
What do you do?
I take it and slice it very, very thin on the bias across the toe of the garlic to expose that whole center ridge. And I make it as thin I could read the newspaper through it. And I throw those slices of extremely thin garlic. It exposes all of the sides in the center of the garlic, and it allows that wonderful garlic flavor to kind of resonate through that olive oil very mm-hmm. quickly, or that butter, and plus you retain the look of the garlic. I really like that a lot. And garlic becomes sweet after it's infused the oil with that wonderful garlic resin, that garlic flavor. So then you have a nice sweet piece of almost like an onion, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yet it has a garlic. And of course, being cut so thin, it's going to fall apart very easily, especially if you throw it in. So I'm take a quarter pound of butter and melt it, and then put that cup of minced onions and, of course, the red and green bell pepper, half cup each. And then about six cloves of garlic sliced very, very thin, and I throw that in last and just kind of simmer it in those vegetables until the garlic is softened. I add about 4 tablespoons of Worcestershire sauce. I put a little hot sauce in there, too. Any one of your Louisiana favorites, about a tablespoon or so. Season that with salt and pepper. Then a little Creole seasoning can go into it as well. And once all of that is cooked, I take 2 pounds of crawfish tails and I chop them just coarsely with a knife, and I throw it into that mixture, and I saute that around so that those onions and garlic and all of that will now be fully infused with this wonderful chopped crawfish tails that went into 2 pounds. Then after about 10 minutes of cooking, I take it out, put it in a bowl, cool it slightly, and then I'll add to that 2 whipped eggs, and you got to put them in real fast and stir them so they don't scramble, right? That's why you want to cool that crawfish stuffing a little bit. So 2 eggs beaten, 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese will go into that, and I say 1 cup of Italian breadcrumbs, but just enough Italian breadcrumbs to hold the mixture together. I do not want a bready stuffing. So what you're doing is making a wonderful crawfish stuffing that's held together with cheese, breadcrumbs, and 2 beaten eggs, but yet flavored with that wonderful bell pepper, garlic, Worcestershire, hot sauce, and a little Creole seasoning. So now you're making a little boulette. You know, you have a little meatball of this crawfish, and of course they're perfect to bread and just fry right there. You can make like a crab cake with that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go into the shell at that point.
If you ruin the noodles like I do,
then you can make that. Absolutely. So then you're going to go ahead and take the noodles that have been poached and cooled, right? You're going to take, they've been chilled in cold water.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think you had the trouble with the noodles? Why do you think you overcooked them? It said to cook them 12 minutes. Did you cook them longer than that, or did you, what do you think happened that created the issue for you?
I probably cooked them too long, and it's been a little while since I did this. It's a fabulous recipe, and it was delicious. I think I cooked that pasta too long, and I remember actually being on the phone with you when I was trying to do this, and you walked me through it. You know, you did a beautiful job walking me through it, and it was delicious, but I think I cooked the noodles too long.
Well, what happens, I think people generally don't realize the detriment of overcooking mm-hmm. your pasta. If pasta is supposed to cook in 10 to 12 minutes, 10 to 12 minutes is when you should dump it out of that, but you have to put it in boiling, lightly salted water and wait till the water comes back to a boil to time it.
Mm.
The minute it starts to simmer again, you time it for 12 minutes or 10 minutes, whatever you want. I always do mine al dente, which is a little bit less than cooked, because uh-huh. I want to cook it in the sauce again. Plus, I want to chew a little pasta. I don't want it to be like
mush.
So if it calls for 12 minutes, bring it back to a boil, and once it comes back to a boil, time it. If it says 12, cook it 11. 11. And then you're going to have what's called al dente to the tooth, you know, that you can still chew in it a little bit. And with the pasta shells, they're so big that, and because they are large and the small, we're using the large pasta shells here. You want to put it into the water and boil it and have that cold water ready to go so that once you get to that 12 minutes that it's got to be cooked, you're going to pour them out at 11 minutes. They're still al dente, but remember, they're going to go and bake again. So they're going
right.
to cook to finish once they've been stuffed, and then you're not going to have that trouble. By the same token, you don't want to undercook them because these pasta shells are really large, and you don't want to have uncooked large shells. It's about technique, and if the package says to cook them for 12 minutes to done, that will be accurate. 12 minutes will be done, so don't cook them 13.
Yeah.
It's better to cook them 11 than to cook them 13, right?
And you know what? It could have been the problem. Maybe my pot wasn't big enough, you know, because now I've learned you do need more water, right, when you're cooking pasta?
The Italians always say, I wish I could say it in Italian because it's really nice. They said, always give your pasta enough water to swim.
Yeah.
In other words, so you have twice the water you have of the pasta. That way the pasta can swim in the water. You never want it to a point where it's starchy.
Yeah.
If you don't put enough water in, it's going to get starchy and then your noodles fall apart. So you got to...
That may be exactly what I did.
Yeah, you got to... It's better to have 10 times the water than 1-to-1.
Mm-hmm.
Because the pasta needs enough water to swim. Remember that at all times. So then you're going to stuff the pasta shells, the chilled pasta shells, with this wonderful crawfish stuffing. And if you have any crawfish stuffing left, just make some little patties. You can do a hamburger patty and put them on a burger bun, or you can make a little like a crab cake and saute them for supper that night while waiting as an appetizer before the pasta.
That'd be delicious.
Would be really nice. So then you're going to go ahead and fill up the pasta shells with this wonderful mixture that you've made. The cheese and the breadcrumbs, of course, will hold it all together. And then I put the shells in a 9x13 baking pan, and I'm going to cover it with a sauce. Now, what sauce would I use? You know what somebody told me the other day? And I have to tell you, I tried it just because I thought it was important to know it worked well.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody told me they went to the store, they made this recipe, and then the recipe called for making a sauce of Kitty Ann, which I included in the recipe, which was boiling some crawfish shells, making a nice crawfish-flavored stock, and then thickening it with a little roux, a little white roux, to make this wonderful pink sauce that had a lot of crawfish flavor.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, they didn't want to do that. That took too much time. They didn't have crawfish shells. So they went to the store, and they got 2 cans of shrimp soup in the can.
Oh.
Can like Campbell's soup. One of the brands of soup, right?
Mm-hmm.
They reconstituted 1 can of water to soup, so now they had a wonderful shrimp-flavored soup. And they poured it over the shells.
Oh, wow.
And all they did was they added a little bell pepper to it, and they made it kind of look nice. I added some parsley and green onions to it, threw a little tarragon in it. They were invented.
And you tried it?
I tried it. It was absolutely fantastic. I added a squeeze of tomato to it, and you could have swore it was my Kitty Ann sauce. So I'm all about convenience food, right?
Sure.
So, y'all, the recipe is on the website, jfalls.com. If you go to jfalls.com, if you go to Stirring It Up, it's all right there. I would definitely recommend, y'all, that you add to your library. We encourage you to build your culinary library 1 week at a time. And making artisanal pasta, Lisa Green, is a wonderful book. It's not an expensive little book, and you can get it at all the stores. And if you go to her website, which will be on our website, I guarantee you'll find all of her information. She's a wonderful person. We must call her to Louisiana.
Absolutely.
She seems like our kind of people. You know?
Oh, definitely kindred spirit. Yeah. Anybody that's going to go to Central Grocery before they leave to go home and carry that on the plane, hey, I don't know how. You know, my greatest question was, how in the world did that muffalata survive the trip?
I thought the exact same thing.
Well, anyway, y'all, we thank you so much for being with us. We do love hearing from you. So if you go to Stirring It Up Radio on our Facebook, we'd love to hear some topics that you might want to hear. We're going to be doing some fun shows on everything from canning and your gardens. You know, some of the spring gardens in, everybody's well.
Mm-hmm.
People already starting to ask, what I do with my baby beets? I said, make some pickles out of them.
Bring them to me?
Oh, tell me how to do them. Yeah, tell me how to do them. Anyway, y'all, hey, we love you. Thank you so much for being here. Go cook some pasta, you know what I mean? And invite somebody over to eat with you.